Welcome to Look as Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In 2015, President Barack Obama issued a plan to restore 7 million acres of land for pollinators and called it the National Strategy to Promote the Health of Honeybees and Other Pollinators. While that was a good start, it doesn't address the 4,000 species of native bees in the United States, most of whom you probably have never heard of. Today we talk with Paige Embry, author of Our Native Bees, about the plight of the bees that permeate our regional landscapes, the workhorses who pollinate the huge percentage of our native plants, orchards, and fields. Paige, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, you start your book, this book about native bees, by talking about honeybees. So I wanted, why did you start with honeybees? Because as a lot of us have learned, much to our surprise over the last few years, honeybees are not native.
Well, you know, when I first decided to write the book, I had thought of it as a book about America's bees rather than native bees. And so when it sort of came down to native bees, it's like most people's conception of what a bee is often revolves around honeybees. And so I thought that was something that I needed to address in the book, both because that's what most people think of as bees and because they are an important part of our bee landscape.
Well, one of the things we've been hearing a lot about honeybees for a number of years now is that there's this whole situation of colony collapse, and we're afraid that they're going to be dying out, and there's all kinds of issues and debate about why they're dying out. And there's been talk about who would replace them in terms of the important role of pollinators. So first of all, I wanted to talk a little bit about what is happening to our honeybee population in the United States. Is it under? Is it threatened actually with extinction? And how important a role do honeybees play in pollination?
Oh, okay. So the honeybees are beset by a whole host of different problems. And colony collapse disorder isn't a problem at the moment. It was there for a while, and it hit the news in a big way. But there are other issues that are bigger issues for the honeybees, and one of them is this mite, sort of spider-like creature that came in and both sort of is a parasite and spreads viruses and things like that when it bites the bees. So that's probably, if you ask a lot of bee people, what's the biggest problem that honeybees have at the moment, a lot of them may well say the varroa mites. But there's a whole host of other problems. And so for commercial beekeepers, they lose a lot of colonies each year, but they've sort of figured out how to manage them at the moment.
So is there an issue? Is there an issue with honeybees not being able to service all the pollination needs that we have in this country? Both particularly for commercial agriculture, but also just for the rest of nature.
For commercial agriculture, again, the beekeepers have sort of figured out how to manage the problem that the bees are facing at the moment. That doesn't mean that something can't come along and throw the system off and cause problems for commercial pollination, especially at the beginning of the season. About three quarters of all of the commercial honeybees in the country end up going to pollinate the almond orchards in California, and then they spread out to pollinate a bunch of others. So that's a lot of bees that are needed very early in the season before honeybees have sort of started building their numbers. So could problems develop? Absolutely. Do the people that I've talked to in the honeybee world seem to be thinking that the bees could just disappear? No. Could there be serious problems? Yes.
So why is there concern about trying other kinds of bees, particularly native bees, or primarily native bees, to substitute for some of the roles that honeybees have been playing?
Well, there's, who doesn't want a backup? So there's that piece. It's like, well, if we do have a bad year, it's good to have some backups in place. So there's that part. And there's also the fact that, honeybees are fine pollinators, but all bees don't pollinate the same way. So there's research out there that shows that having more than one kind of pollinator can actually be really beneficial to pollination. So you can, not only are you sort of having the backup if the honeybees are having a bad year, potentially, but You also may get better pollination by having two or three or four or more kinds of bees in your fields pollinating your plants.
Well, you say in the beginning of the book that one of your original titles for the book was Honeybees Don't Pollinate Tomatoes. So what was that revelation, and what does that show you about our needing to maybe develop a little more in-depth understanding of bees?
I had been a gardener for a long time and had grown plenty of tomatoes and hadn't realized that honeybees can't pollinate tomatoes because tomatoes need a special kind of pollination called buzz pollination. And so when you go and look at a lot of plants, like a lily, for example, you'll look at the anthers, the sort of male part of the plants, and there'll be pollen on the outside of the anther. So any insect, any bee can come along and just take that pollen. But tomatoes and a bunch of other kinds of plants actually hide the pollen inside the anthers, and you have to shake them out to get the pollen out. And one of the ways of doing that is a bee holds onto it with part of its mouth and shivers its wing muscles at a specific frequency, and it shakes the pollen out like salt out of a salt shaker. And honeybees don't know how to do it.
Well, which bees do?
Bumblebees are super at that, but there are a host of native bees that do it. And there's actually one bee that I know of in Maine that uses another method. It's called the Maine blueberry bee because blueberries also need to be buzz pollinated. And it apparently gets up in a little blueberry flower, which is a little white urn-shaped flower, and it drums on the anthers with its front legs.
Well, one of the things that's really fascinating in getting to understand bees, and you're actually the second bee person I've talked to in the show in the last couple of years, and the other person basically just wrote this encyclopedia of bees. Didn't have the same storyline that your book has, but in that book too, I learned about the real distinctions between many, many different life habits that bees have and different patterns. And I guess the one that's the most noticeable is whether bees are social bees or solitary bees. So let's talk a little bit about which bees are social and which are solitary, and what that would mean, and also how would that influence their ability to pollinate?
Ah, okay. So the social bee, most of us think bees are social because the bee that we know the most about is the honeybee, and they are the queens of social bees. So for social bees, you've got one queen who lays the eggs, and then there will be multiple generations of female workers who do the work. And for bees, they divvy up the workload in astonishing ways. There's bees that fly out, and they're just going out to get pollen. And then there's other bees that fly out, and they're just going to get nectar. And then there's bees that are looking after the babies and bees that are looking after the queen. So it's a very organized society. And what makes honeybees completely unique in North America, so far as we know, is that their colonies last from 1 year to the next. They're perennial. There are other social bees in America where you have a queen and you have a bunch of her daughters who are working with her, and the bumblebees are the best known of that group. But their colonies are annual. So at the end of, sort of the warm weather, all the bees die except for next year's queens who have been impregnated, and they go find a little hole and sleep through the winter. So those are the social bees. The solitary bees emerge at a certain time of year, and that's when they mate, and then the males die because males are really just all about having sex. And the females then gather pollen and nectar to feed their babes and lay an egg on a little pollen and nectar wad, and then they sort of close that egg and food off and just start on the next one. They never see their offspring alive, and they usually only live out when they're flying around and laying eggs for about a month, as opposed to those social colonies, which will last for often many months, or for honeybees, potentially for years.
So does this have any impact on their kind of relationship to the plants that they, in a way that they nurture and that they help in their own processes of procreation?
Well, so solitary bees nest, one at a time. And so you have to have nest areas that are available for lots of bees, for the solitary bees to make a big difference for pollination purposes, whereas with a honeybee colony, you may have tens of thousands of workers available. For a bumblebee colony, you know, dozens to maybe 100 or more available sort of in one spot. That being said, there are quite a few of those solitary bees that even though they don't live and work together, they may nest really close together and so can provide a lot of bees and pollination as well. So there's some ground nesting bees that will they'll dig little holes in the ground, but they may only be inches away from another bee of the same kind that makes the hole. So you can get a whole bunch in one area, even though they're solitary. So there's a lot of variability. And again, it tends to be beneficial for pollination to have a variety of kinds of bees available.
Oh, this, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Paige Embry, author of Our Native Bees, who is in Seattle. And when you're describing these solitary bees that are maybe even nesting very close together and maybe not exactly collectively pollinating the same way that honeybees do, but still having the same impact, it seems like it'd be very hard to cultivate them, to domesticate them, and have like a whole, you know, huge number of solitary bees that you would bring out to a field the way you bring out honeybees.
That's true. So there is, so far as I know, only one place where there are ground nesting managed bees, and that's out near Walla Walla, Washington, where they grow a lot of alfalfa for seed crops. And one of the bees that they use in the fields is called an alkali bee, and it nests in the ground, and it's solitary, and it has very specific needs for what kind of dirt that it likes to nest in. And so some of the farmers out there have sort of developed areas for these bees, and then they go out and they pollinate the alfalfa seed. There are other solitary bees that don't nest in the ground, but they nest in like pre-made above-ground holes. So like just out in the wild, it might be a beetle burrow, but you can put out drilled, like a wooden block that's been drilled, or paper tubes, and they'll nest in those. And so those bees are actually very portable, and those are ones that two versions of that that do get used in commercial pollination, and one is called the blue orchard bee, and that's a springtime bee, and the other is the alfalfa leaf-cutting bee, and that's also used in those alfalfa seed fields. It's probably used in other areas as well, and so since they nest in these above-ground holes, you can put out sort of pre-made holes for them, and you know where they've nested, and you can collect them and move them around.
So I'm just curious how you domesticate wild bees.
That seems to be a process that takes many, many years. And so they're in the world. There's 4,000 species of bees in the U.S. and about 20,000 in the world. And there are maybe a dozen species that have been domesticated or managed. But there's a lot of wild bees out there that nobody's managing that do a huge amount of pollination, even in commercial fields where there's places for them to nest and particularly sometimes alternate flowers for them to forage on. So they can be a huge boost even for farms, as well as, of course, for all the wild plants that are out there.
So I'm seeing that use is kind of the equivalent of, like, in my garden, I don't raise bees, but I grow a number of things that attract bees and butterflies and hummingbirds. Is it the same thing on a commercial scale where you would have the right kinds of plants and ground cover or ground itself to attract certain wild bees while you're not, it's not the same as a beekeeper bringing in their hives and setting up shop for a few weeks?
Yeah, no, there's definitely, let's say the wild blueberries in Maine, there's a whole array of options. Honeybees are not good pollinators of blueberries because they need buzz pollination. But when they go to get nectar, they sort of bump into the plant and so do some incidental pollination. So they're helpful, but not nearly as good at it as a lot of the wild bees are. And so there are growers in Maine who will bring in honeybees to help with their pollination, and there are other growers who just who rely on whatever wild bees happen to be there. There are other growers that may use bumblebees, which can also be, they're a managed bee that can be bought. So there's a whole array of options there, but some people are just relying on the wild bees, at least in some years, to sort of do the job.
Well, one bee that I've just been learning about, and I think you mentioned it briefly in your book, is the mason bee. I was at the local organic feed store where I do a lot of my shopping here in Portland, and a few months ago they had a big display up for mason bees, and I was there yesterday and asked them about the mason bees. He said, well, the season's over. I mean, it's too late to buy them this year. They'll have them again next year. But I'm wondering if we could talk a bit about mason bees, what they do and why they are seeming to be popular, particularly for urban farmers.
So honeybees are... they don't like to go out sometimes when it's cold or rainy or windy. They'll just stay in the hive. They've got good, you know, good stores of honey in there, so they can sort of wait out the bad weather. So many honeybees don't go out when the weather's not great. But in early spring, when a lot of the tree fruit are in bloom, especially here in the Pacific Northwest, we've got a lot of chilly, rainy days. And so one of the great things about the orchard mason bee, or the blue orchard bee, its proper name is Osmia ligneria, is that it's willing to go out and work and do some pollination when the weather is cooler than honeybees will. So having them around can be a huge benefit, even if you have honeybees. The other thing about these bees that's, well, there's many cool things about them, but one of the things is they are more efficient pollinators of early blooming fruit trees than honeybees are. So whereas, like, if you look at a commercial orchard, let's say almonds, they'll put 2 honeybee colonies out per acre. And if you assume 10,000 workers per colony, so that's 20,000 bees, you can replace one of those colonies with just 400 female blue orchard bees. And so, again, they're much more efficient. So that's another reason why people are going to say, ooh, I want some of these. So you're more likely to get pollination, and they can be very efficient. Plus, they're fun to watch.
So when you get mason bees, I'm just kind of curious, like, how do they come, and how do you take care of them? I mean, where do they live?
So you, well, one of the best ways to do it is you buy or drill a home for them, and you put it up, like, on the side of a fence or the side of a house, someplace where it's sheltered from the rain and gets warmed up by the sun. And they need to be a specific hole size, and I can't remember what that hole size is, but it's easy to find on the web. And so you could put it up, and if there are some around, they may well come and find your holes and make use of them. But one of the things, they're called mason bees for a reason, because what they do is the females go out and they collect pollen and nectar, and they put it in one of those holes, which is, I don't know, maybe a little skinnier than a skinny person's finger. But, you know, they put it in one of the holes, and then they build a wall made of mud. And then they put in their next little pollen and nectar wad and lay an egg on it. So the mud is essential. And if you're someplace where the soil is really sandy, it's not going to work for them because they need the mud as well. So you can, if you know you have sandy soils, you can go to a friend that has mud, or you can probably buy some mud and put in a little nice wet mud pit for them. And how they arrive is, I've bought them twice. Once was a long time ago, and what I got is, sometimes one of the things you can do is put out these little, like, paper tubes for them. And so the first time I bought them, I just got a couple of paper tubes, and there were little cocoons lined up inside that paper tube. And when the time is right, they will chew through their cocoons and come out. And they chew through the mud walls as well. the second time I got them more recently, they came in this tiny little box like the size of a Max Botch, and somebody had already removed the cocoons from the tube and just put the cocoons in the matchbox. So, you know, it ships very economically. So you end up with a little box with these little brown cocoons that are about the size of a Tylenol capsule.
And then what do you do with them?
If it is about the right time for them to come out, you put them outside in wherever your bee house is so they can sort of emerge when the time is right. If it's still potentially too cold out, you can store them in the refrigerator for a while.
So one of the stereotypes we have about bees is we think about honeycombs. And I'm wondering if other wild bees, if wild bees do anything equivalent to honeycombs.
For the most part, no. Part of why honeybees make honey is to, they need, because they're perennial, they last through the winter, they need something to sort of keep the bees that are around in the winter fed. So that's part of why they have honey. And since most bees are in die, and with just sort of, you know, the beginning of next year's generation around, and those bees are usually in what something called diapause, a sort of hibernation-like state, so they're not eating during the winter. But bumblebees will make these cute little waxen cups, and they will put some nectar in those waxen cups, and so that's at least a couple of days' supply. And there are other bees not in the U.S. that will make honey, but there aren't any in the U.S. that make honey.
And
so
what,
that the bumblebee's storing a little bit of nectar, you know, there may be a few other bees, because there's a lot we don't know about bees still, that may have some small-scale storage going on as well, but nothing like what you see with honeybees.
So, I mean, you couldn't really get honey from a bumblebee, could you?
No.
Well, it's interesting, as I think about the bees in my neighborhood, and mostly they're bumblebees, and then there's a lot of honeybees. And after reading your book, I've realized I probably should look more closely and see if some of these other creatures that are flying around are another kind of bee I haven't seen before. But what about the bumblebees? I mean, because they seem to be in a great abundance. And what is their relationship to the things that we grow and the things that grow around us?
They are fabulous pollinators. They are, so bees, you know, you can divvy bees up in a bunch of ways, and one of them that you already brought up was the whole social versus solitary. But another thing is that some bees are generalists. They will collect pollen from a bunch of different kinds of plants to lay down for their babes to eat, and some bees are specialists. They only take pollen from certain plants or maybe a group of plants, of related plants. And bumblebees are generalist. And so they go out and pollinate lots of different kinds of plants. And they have the ability to do buzz pollination. And some of the, and they have a long, you know, again, because they're social, there's multiple generations a year. So they have a long season. So there's a lot of benefits to them. And I'm glad to hear that you've got a lot of them in your area. There must be some good nesting ground around for them.
Well, actually, one of the things I think draws them, I have a neighbor down the street who has her parking strip is all planted in lavender. And,
uh-huh.
And it's actually, and I'm not sure, it's a very common lavender with a lavender flower. It's not one of the, you know, the more fancy Spanish or lavenders. And but I also notice them. I have a lot of lavender around my house, not nearly as much. And I notice them around the lavender. Is that a special attraction to bumblebees?
I don't know if it's a special attraction to bumblebees, but it tends, especially, again, sort of the, as you say, the more old-fashioned kind of lavender. There's a professor down in California who has been sort of tracking bees in gardens. And one of his favorite plants for bees is Provence lavender. Provence is a cultivar of lavender, and he says that he has found over 50 different species of bees on Provence lavender. So it's not just the bumblebees that are probably thoroughly enjoying you and your neighbor's lavender, but a bunch of other bees, some of them maybe really sort of small and innocuous as well.
Actually, I'm thinking that there's also a lot of honeybees that are attracted to it. So the bumblebees and the honeybees are kind of interacting on that lavender.
Yeah, no, again, it's, and one of the nice things for lavender is it tends to have a pretty long bloom season, and there's a lot of it often in one area, and that makes life a lot easier for a bee, because sometimes it takes them a while to figure out how to get the nectar and pollen from a flower, and once they've sort of worked with a certain kind of flower for a while, they get more efficient. And so it's easy to go back to that same place again and again and again. And it's nice when there's a big clump of flowers somewhere so that they don't have to do a lot of traveling on a collecting trip.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kibwe Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking with Paige Embry, who's author of Our Native Bees. Now, a big thing in the news over the last few years has been, as we started talking about a little bit in the beginning of the show, the different diseases that are striking bees. And it's not just diseases, it's also just sudden bee deaths. It was a horrible couple occasions a few years ago where I don't know how many thousands of bumblebees were killed by at this, I forget which store, just south of Portland, where they had been spraying these ornamental trees with a bee poison. It was, I think it was international news. But I wanted to talk about some of the threats. And one of the things I remember in your book is this is fungicides, I guess, that they use on the almond orchards in California, which were killing honeybees. And certainly there's this whole thing with the neonicotinoids. So let's talk about some of the threats to not just bumblebees and, well, not just honeybees, but wild bees in general, and what the growing awareness, I guess, we have of what some of these threats are that are coming especially from pesticides.
There's the obvious thing of if you're spraying an insecticide when bees are going to be visiting a plant, well, bees are insects too, as well as whatever it is that you're actually trying to kill, so you're going to run the risk of killing the bees. But there's also, you mentioned the fungicides, there are sometimes things that it's like, well, this is not an insecticide, but that doesn't mean that it can't be harmful to bees as well. So, there is labeling on pesticides to say what they're harmful for and how to use them. But one of the things I found out when I was researching the book was that, historically at least, how they determine if a pesticide is harmful to a group of animals is they will test it. But, of course, there's 4,000 different species of bees in the U.S., and some of them are quite different from each other. And what they test the pesticide on, again, historically it's changing a bit, is adult worker honeybees. They don't test it on the males or the queens or the larvae. They don't test it on any of the other bees. And so even if a pesticide is safe for adult worker honeybees, we don't know if it's safe for some of these other bees. So again, as a homeowner, it's just like, well, the safest thing to do is you just don't spray. And that way I know that I'm not spraying anything. And, the other thing is, it's like, well, you don't spray when things are flowering. So there are things that you can do. So that's sort of the quick pesticide piece. Is there something else you were thinking about with the pesticides?
I'm thinking my own. The last time that I had to use a pesticide, and I was using neem oil, which is considered pretty benign, but it still will kill insects. And I was actually using it to kill these beetles and weevils that had come up from Oaks Bottom near where we live and were infesting our neighborhood and eating all the crepe myrtles. And so we were trying to protect our crepe myrtle tree. And when I went to my favorite organic feed store to get the neem oil, they said, well, don't spray it during the day because it will kill pollinators. And so the idea was you sprayed it after the bees were finished pollinating for the day. I'm not sure, how much we know exactly, but when they're there. So that's what we did, and we hoped that we didn't kill any bees. But I think that's another thing. Even when you're using organic or relatively benign pesticides, that there's still concern that they can have a real harmful effect on on pollinators.
No, I think that's an excellent point, that just because it's organic, if the object of the organic substance is to kill insects, then it's still killing insects. It just happens to be organic rather than synthetic. But yes, the piece about spraying at night, if you do need to spray, is definitely the bees do go to bed at night, so that definitely makes things safer. Hopefully, you know, if you have the chance of picking a day or a night where it's maybe supposed to be warm early in the morning, so that hopefully all of the pesticide has completely dried before the bees are out and foraging again, can be helpful. There are some pesticides that even after they're dry, when a critter walks on it, it can be bad for them. And I truthfully don't know if, like, which pesticides those are and if they are, you know, how many of them are actually available, if any, for homeowners to buy, because there's pesticides that you have to have licenses to use, so they're not available to homeowners.
Well, I'm thinking even in the case of using something as benign as neem oil, the fact that you're trying to kill one variety of insects, I don't think that neem oil is discriminates.
No, it definitely, I would not, I don't know what all neem oil kills, so yes, you can't be sure unless you read all the literature on it.
And I mean, I think that experience I had with, you know, that's the first time I'd used pesticides probably ever since I moved into this house. And it really made me aware of that we have to find some other way, that when I was given this choice of, do I protect my crepe myrtle or do I protect the bees, it's not a choice that I want to be making. So I wonder if there's any, if you know of any research or other things where people are trying other ways of doing pest control that will discriminate and will only target the insects that are harmful, I mean, the ones that are killing your trees, as opposed to the ones that are helping your trees to live and thrive.
You know, that, again, there's the integrated pest management approach to dealing with pests, and I would think down in Oregon, you know, the Oregon State University people are going to be totally on top of that and have a lot of worksheets, especially for some of the more common pests that you're dealing with sort of, okay, when it crosses a threshold, you know, try this or try that. And the other thing is, I think it's, we've, a lot of us come to think that our plants should be pristine, that there shouldn't be any problems or little eaten parts of them. And it's one thing when it's like, well, there is a pest that is actually killing my trees or completely defoliating my trees. And then there's the, well, you know, it's looking a little tattered, but it seems to be doing fine. And again, learning to be tolerant of those low levels and sort of watching the plants, that's part of the integrated pest management thing of, it's like, okay, when have we crossed some threshold from, okay, it's not perfect, but it's fine, to, okay, maybe I need to take some action. And that's when you go to, again, whatever your state land-grant university usually has great extension sources for those kinds of things.
Well, I wanted to get into probably one of your favorite subjects, which is, what are your favorite bees?
So I am from a looking at point of view, probably one of my favorite bees, well, it's just one of my favorite bees altogether, is called Melisodes. It's a it's called a longhorn bee because the males have really long antenna. But most of the females, so bees, female bees need to carry pollen, a very dusty substance, back to where they're laying their eggs. And so they've got hairs. Most of them have hairs on their body, somewhere mostly on their hind legs, but maybe on their underside of their abdomen where they carry them. And some have sort of scanty little hairs, and some have a whole lot. And Melisodes have so much hair on their hind legs that they look like they're wearing, you know, those 1980s flash dance kind of style leg warmers. And they're sort of fat, fuzzy bees, so they're just cute. And the males, and I know other bees do this as well, but often the males, these are, Melisodes are at least for the most part solitary bees, but the males often seem to like to congregate, like at night when it's time to go to bed, and they all sort of sleep together on a stem, hanging onto it with their mandibles. So I just, they're definitely one of my favorite bees. And there is a cool bee called, there's a Serotina, which is a little bitty, sort of shiny, almost hairless bee, and there's one of them that lives in the east that has an interesting way of living. So these bees are called small carpenter bees, and so they'll go like into a broken stem and sort of hollow out that stem. They like pithy stems that, you know, it's easy to sort of clean out. And the female will lay her egg on a pollen wad, just like a solitary bee will, but she's not social, but she's not solitary either. She's somewhere in between. So she'll lay all of her eggs, but she doesn't die before they hatch. And she actually sort of will go in and check on them and make sure parasites haven't gotten in. And so then all of her offspring will hatch, and they need some food. But they don't leave their nest to go get food. Instead, the mother goes and actually brings food back to them, but she doesn't do it all by herself. The very first egg she laid, she gave it this puny little pollen wad. And so how big a bee gets depends on how big their pollen wad is. And so that first bee is called the dwarf eldest daughter because she's little bitty. And the mother makes dwarf eldest daughter go out and help gather food to feed her brothers and sisters. But because she does all this work and because she's so small, she doesn't have she won't have the stores necessary to be able to survive the winter. So she's never going to be able to start her own nest. And so some people have nicknamed her Cinderella.
Actually, there's some very strange bee behavior you describe, which, I mean, I think I've always kind of romanticized bees, but some bees have some pretty nasty behaviors. For instance, the parasitic bees, which really kind of amaze me.
Yeah. Yeah, so there is a whole group of bees that that sneak into the nest of other bees and lay their eggs there. And for a lot of the solitary bees, what happens is when the egg hatches and the little larva, the sort of bee equivalent of a caterpillar, when the larva emerges for the parasitic bee, it will kill the other bee that's in there, the host bee's baby, and then eat up the pollen wad that was laid down for the host bee. And it seems very dastardly, but its parasites are part of the ecosystem and often are a sign that an ecosystem is functioning well. So we sort of look at it and think, you dastardly bee, you. When actually having them around is a good sign.
Why is it a good sign? What does it indicate?
It is, again, there's a whole host of niches in the world, and it's like if you get too many of a certain kind of bee, you get the parasites coming in and sort of helping to regulate some of that bit, and it's not good for the, clearly, for the individual bee involved. But again, for having a well-functioning ecosystem, you want lots of checks and balances in the ecosystem.
So it's kind of like...
It's like if you take out the carnivores, you know, all of the herbivores sort of start running amok because you'll get too many herbivores when you take out the carnivores. So that too, is part of having a good, well-functioning ecosystem. So you want checks and balances.
I was thinking it's kind of like the role that the bark beetles used to play in the forest before things got out of hand, where they actually just helped to thin the forest of weak trees. But, of course, when things get out of hand, I'm wondering if things are still in hand in the bee universe, or if there are signs of imbalance the same way that we see in a lot of the rest of nature now.
Oh, that's a good question. I'm trying to think if I had run across... there are certainly bees out in the wild that are having problems. And there have, you know, whether the parasites and plagues among the wild bees might be growing, I don't know. I would say that one of the biggest problems, you know, you'd asked earlier about sort of the problems bees are facing and brought up pesticides. But one of the biggest problems that bees are facing is loss of habitat. So it's not exactly addressing your question of sort of more like, are there parasites or diseases getting out of control? But again, the habitat loss is having a big impact on how well bees are doing. So habitat loss is out of control.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that. Right now, though, you're listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. We're talking about bees and native bees, wild bees in particular, with Paige Emery, who's the author of Our Native Bees. Well, one of the things that was interesting in your book was talking about these bee-friendly golf courses. And after going through a long disclaimer of how you've never been into golf and you don't believe in golf and you don't believe in golf courses, you were interested in what was happening there. And do you think, let's talk a bit about what a bee-friendly golf course would be and why they're even being proposed.
So I got interested in this when I ran across a program called Operation Pollinator. And it's a program that is run by Syngenta, one of the enormous agribusiness companies that deals with pesticides. And it's like, well, that seems like an awfully odd choice for them to be doing.
Actually, and GMOs, they were kind of one of the villains in Southern Oregon in terms of trying to plant all these GMO crops in Jackson County. That's another thing to throw in there. Maybe we can kind of weave that around what you're about to say.
So I got in touch with them because I wanted to find out a little bit more about it. And one of the people who works for Syngenta said that when the program got started in England, part of how they ended it, it started with farms, but part of how they got onto the golf course was they, of course, supply many of the chemicals used on golf courses, sort of fertilizers and pesticides and those kinds of things, and said that some of their golf clients were sort of, again, interested in maybe having some more wildlife. And I can't remember exactly how that came about. But they ended up developing this program to support having pollinators. And really, it's, you know, they help with sort of PR and maybe some how-to bits, but then it's up to the golf courses. But there's this guy at Rivermont Golf Course in the suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia, who already had sort of a let's try something different with a golf course attitude. And so he is not completely running the golf course in an organic way, but he's trying all sorts of alternative. He's got this huge worm hotel, multi-level worm hotel, and he makes compost tea, and he uses that on the golf course. So somebody like that is ripe for, it's like, well, let's take some little area that's, you know, in the rough and turn it into a habitat area. And so that's what some of these golf courses are doing, and sometimes it's a small area and sometimes it's bigger. And it's only been around for, I don't know, 5-7 years, not that long. But a lot of golf courses seem to like the idea. It gives them some good PR. But also, it might be easier to look after some of these areas than if they're out there having to mow and fertilize and stuff. So it was actually quite beautiful, that golf course.
So does Syngenta, in promoting these kind of habitat-friendly golf courses, are they still promoting that these golf courses use their chemicals, their fertilizers, and their pesticides? Because that seems like it would kill the kind of wildlife that you're trying to encourage in the native habitat areas.
Yes, they certainly, Syngenta is still selling to some of these. And I know, and again, this is just my little anecdotal from talking to, you know, one or two people in the golf world, so I certainly don't have all the answers. The golf course manager was a little bit, it's like, okay, I'm trying to achieve XYZ, and he would go to his pharmaceutical rep and say, I'm trying to achieve XYZ, and they would try and work with him on achieving XYZ, and sometimes those things were, again, about maybe not such wholesale killing. So he seemed to, you know, have a feel good that they were trying to support, that they were supportive of his efforts to do a lot of his golf course organically. That, and again, I don't know, that's just, again, based on the conversation that I had with him. And you can certainly, you know, you would think, since those chemicals cost a fair amount of money, being having areas of the golf course where you don't have to use them saves them money and protects those areas. So you could just sort of, there's going to be areas that where they choose to use some of those chemicals and areas where they don't.
Well, you talked a little bit earlier about habitat loss being perhaps the greatest threat to bees. So I wanted to talk in the last part of the show about what's the concerns. I mean, how is habitat being lost? Because I don't think it's just from suburbanization. Some of that lost habitat is also happening on large agricultural land. And I wonder what can be done to reverse that. How do we need to kind of rethink both the way we live and the way we grow food in order to promote healthy habitat for pollinators?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. Again, sort of on the sort of jumping from the golf course thing, which you think golf course and you think grass, but the U.S. has somewhere between 30 and 40 million acres of lawn. And most of that is not going to be very beneficial to pollinators. But if we just sort of rethink what a perfect lawn looks like and let a few flowers creep into the lawn, think about how much habitat that would create. And not just habitat, but sort of continuous habitat. Because part of, you know, some of those little bitty bees, they can't fly very far from wherever they're living to the flowers. And so you need to have as much continuous habitat as you can. So part of it is about loss of habitat and also fragmentation of habitat, because they can't necessarily fly from one little habitat island to another. So we want to try and create pathways for them to be able to fly along. And lawn might be a good way of doing that. So that's one piece. And I know some people are like, oh, no, we couldn't possibly let clover or other flowers in the lawn. But I'm hoping people will start rethinking about what makes for a good-looking lawn and thinking that maybe some of these flowers in the lawn are good.
Actually, one of the flowers that I've had a lot of discussions about lately are dandelions, which I understand are really good for pollinators. And in fact, I've been having some discussions with my partner about how many dandelions to keep in our yard. I mean, they do get very ugly when they go to seed. And there's this fear of, like, when they go to seed, oh, no, now we're going to have a million dandelions. But maybe a million dandelions is not so bad.
Yes, there have certainly been research projects that find that yes, dandelions are provide good forage for a host of different pollinators, and clover does as well. And you know, there was a recent study done in New England where they found on some lawns where they weren't spraying, so flowers would grow. That if you mowed once every 2 weeks rather than once a week, so the flowers had more of a chance to actually flower, that they found, I can't remember, I think nearly 100 species of pollinators feasting on some of these lawns. And so even something as simple as, like, well, I'll let the grass get a little longer and I'll let the flowers grow, you know, that provides habitat for a whole variety of bees, maybe not all the bees that are out there, but a whole variety of bees. And sort of a similar attitude, you know, there are some farms that you go visit, and it's like whatever's growing is all the greenery that you see. And there are other farms that seem to be just as successful, where there is, like, I went to an avocado orchard, and it was like a jungle. There were all of these plants growing underneath the avocados, and there were lots of different kinds of bees and pollinators. But the avocados were working, you know, they were getting good avocado yields, and they were supplying forage for a whole bunch of different kinds of bees and other pollinators. But I think, you know, again, I can't speak to what the farmers think and why they choose sort of the clean sweep versus the other, you know, method where you let some of the weeds grow. But there certainly is a growing amount of research showing that if you provide some of that nesting area and alternate forage, that that the wild bees will make use of it, and it will be helpful in pollinating crops.
Well, I actually know some farmers who very consciously, they let the hedgerows grow and they leave weeds around, and not just weeds. I mean, actually, they're beautiful flowering plants, and they just kind of have changed their definition of what a beautiful field looks like. So I think it's more to do with a mindset change than it has to do with what actually is good farming practice.
Yeah, because again, there are definitely farmers out there. It's like one that I spoke to, and he's like, yeah, other farmers come and see my orchard with all of the plants, some of them planted, some of them just sort of weediness, and he's like, they're appalled, and others are like, think it's good. So there is a big mindset piece. I agree with you.
Well, getting back to lawns, because I'm kind of an anti-lawn person myself, and I wonder if that's another thing of people, because a lot of people in my neighborhood have like been digging up their lawns and planting and plants and flowering plants and blueberry bushes and all kinds of things. And maybe there's a way we could start to appreciate that there's something else we can do with our yards besides just growing grass.
Ah, yes. And there's going to be people who choose to do that and other people who like the idea of lawns. So it's like, well, you know, it's like you can say, I think people should be thinking about if I want a lawn, what do I want it for? And how much land do I really need to devote to that thing that I want the lawn for? And so for some of those people who still want some lawn, it's like, well, maybe I don't need such a big lawn. And maybe the lawn I have, I can let the flowers grow in it. So you can accommodate the people who still want lawns and might still want to be sort of doing something that's good for the bees. And then there's other people who it's like, why on earth would I want lawn when I could plant tomatoes and blueberries or flowers or what have you instead?
Right. Actually, I have just a little bit of lawn in my backyard for my dog to pee on, and that's the only reason I have lawn. Everything else.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, the rest of the lawn is long gone. Well, Paige, it's been really interesting to talk to you, and I want to thank you for writing your book and educating us about our native bees.
Well, thanks a lot for giving me the chance to come on and talk about them.
Sure. We've been talking today with Paige Embry, who's author of Our Native Bees, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, I'll be talking with Amarok Weiss with the Center for Biological Diversity about the increased killing of wolves by state agencies in Oregon and throughout the wolf territory in the western United States. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Taj Mahal. Thanks for listening.